So that little story about the dogs is at least enough to suggest why property is better than commons in some circumstances, worse than others, ultimately depending on the costs of enforcing and making operate a property system. And that becomes a particularly salient question when we think about intellectual property, where some forms are protectable and some aren't, and where copyright and patent give very different sorts of protection. So consider the question I'm putting on the slide here. Note that what I'm saying is not true of all extensions of copyright protection. I'm really thinking of the sort of old model where what you're copyrighting was a book. You're looking puzzled. Sure. Theoretically, patents is for an idea and copyright an expression. So if I figure out a new way of synthesizing a chemical, I can patent that. If I figure out the electric telegraph, as Morse did, I patent the broadest definition of what I've found that I can get through the patent office, in order that it will cover as many things similar to my telegraph as I can. Morse, in fact, tried to patent the internet because his final claim was for all ways of using electromagnetic force to transmit letters or symbols to a distance. But he didn't get that one. That's a different feature I'm not discussing, which is that the patent applicant, in effect, defines the property he's claiming. But the broader it is, the less likely it is to meet the requirements. And part of the problem is that whether a chapter in my book is verbatim the same as yours is really easy to see. But if I make an invention, first, I may have never seen your invention, so even if they're identical, I don't know it. But second, since what you are patenting is not the particular machine you invented, but the ideas that that machine implements, exactly what does or doesn't get covered by that is not at all clear. So the result is that patent is at least providing protection for a form of property where defining the boundary lines and arguing and transacting over them is much harder than for copyright. Yes?
I would have to disagree. I think that copyright has derivative work, right? And so it's not just simple copy, it's not reproduction. And often people will argue over, it's not as clearly defined as you would like to believe. Novelty is not an issue in copyright, though. It doesn't have to be novel. And the people who enforce novelty are like, if you've taken an idea, you're not the idea, the expression from someone else, right? That it's usually another copyright holder says, hey, you're copying my work. And I believe it's just the enforcement, because they don't care that it's novel or not. The only person who's worried about whether it's a copy of the expression is the previous copyright holder. So that's why we give it away so freely. They don't really care. The only person who's concerned with the issuing of new copyrights is somebody who may be worried about their original copyright being infringed upon, being a derivative work of it.
So just to touch on top of that, for example, open source software is a great example of copyright, and license agreements is what transfers over copyrights, for example, and it relates to patents as well. So if I have a software, a patent process, and you can distinguish between patent and copyright, and I think that's what we do it all. At the same time, if I have something, if I'm an original creator of a patent, and I would like to pass this patent along, you know, in order to help everyone, however, he has no, I want to say, because I handed it off so freely, he has no repercussion to hand it off to the next person And not only that, I don't mind that. I want him to hand it off to next person. That's why it's open source software. At the same time, he has no desire to enforce nor monitor what the next person does with the handoff. So I want to hand it off to him. I want him to improve it, but I don't want him to not only improve it in a negative way, but also not only or disimprove, but I don't want him to forget where he got it from. And sometimes as it gets cleaner and cleaner and better, you forget the original, which is what
but
you're referring to.
In the case of open source, however, open source depends on copyright law in order to enforce the requirement that the work using other open source software remain open source. So that if I write soft, if I take an open source project and write my own modified version of it, I don't have the option of distributing that only as object code and not as source code.
Right.
Because if I do so, I will be violating the license that lets me use the copyrighted material that's in my program. So in that case, open source is a very bizarre use of copyright law, that it is really dependent on copyright law to keep things open. But the people who really would object to copyright, to easy copyright in principle, are not the other writers, it's the people who want to make copies.
No, it's not even... The people who are objecting to the new copies are A, original owners, right? So so people who published the first work of Superman, right? Action Comics number one, right? Superman comes out and in 1940 they already sued this guy, Bruce Publishing, and it's essentially the same character, right? So it's a guy with superpower, wear tights, he has a cape, blah blah blah, but it's not Superman. It's not Superman's story, he doesn't have the same sidekick, blah blah blah, but he has the same powers, and they say, this character is our character, we're protecting it. So they wanted the idea of Superman protected, and they got it protected, they did, and they're concerned about that. And that's the thing, the derivative work, they say it's a derivative work, you stole our idea. And even though you don't have to write the exact same chapter of the book, you just have to write a chapter of the book that's close enough.
I'm sorry. If they had said you stole our idea, they would have lost the case.
Well, no, they said you stole our expression.
That's
okay.
Right.
I know. But in my mind, they stole the idea. If I was sitting in panel in court, I would have said he's allowed to
publish. But in fact, if your chapter has all the ideas from my chapter, I have no copyright case at all against you.
They won.
I understand, but that the claim was not they had the ideas. The claim was that what that amounted to was an expression.
Yeah, that's linguistic two-step as far as I'm concerned. Because they won that case and it was idea, essentially.
If it were only, if copyright was in general that pool of idea, then everybody who now gets a patent would get a copyright instead. Mm-hmm. Because a copyright is much easier to get and lasts much longer.
They can't step on inventions easily. But for expressive work, you can carve out a much, much larger section of rights than you're letting on in that slide. It's much more powerful than you're letting on.
I think you're taking the Superman, which is quite an odd case, as if it's the norm rather than the exception. It's certainly true that derivative rights include translation.
Of course.
And they include films. But they do not include another work that used the same ideas. Consider, for example, Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. There's a whole genre of what some of us refer to as extruded fantasy product, which consists of fourth-rate imitations of Lord of the Rings. None of that's covered by Tolkien's copyright.
Terminator, right, the movie? Hmm. Ellison sues and wins to enforce that. He did not write Terminator. It's Greek original fiction. It's a science fiction theme. Ellison has written several books that maybe comport with that idea of a robot coming back to the future. But it's something that he won that right. They didn't copy his works directly. Ideas were taken. And he won. He still won. I'm saying that people are getting rights far beyond what that's like.
I think if you look at ask the bulk of copyright, what it is copying, what it's preventing is literal copying and translation. And that certainly cases like Superman are interesting law school cases, but they don't really describe what the law has mainly been about.
They can't capture an invention. Tons of case law says they can't. They can't try and use trademark to capture copyright.
They also can't use anything independently invented. If the authors of Terminator could demonstrate their scriptwriters had never read Ellison, he would have lost.
Yeah, but how are you? They don't have to demonstrate. They have to demonstrate that they had access to Ellison, not that they never read him.
I said if they had demonstrated they had never read him, you mean they didn't have to demonstrate that he had read him? But if they had been able to demonstrate they hadn't read him, that's the point of the clean room method, which is a way of getting around copyright protection being used for patent-like purposes.
So someone who grew in a cultural clean room is never going to be a good writer. It's impossible. What you're asking for is the impossible.
On the contrary, I just pointed a real-world example where the fact that independent invention is not covered results in things not being protected, namely the way in which the IBM was originally cloned.
Yeah, but that's a clean room. But copyright was being shoehorned, the code was being used and shoehorned into copyright protection at that time, right? So this is more of an oddity. And computer code at a certain point is quite functional, right? And if you have certain coding techniques in your mind, you know how to build a system like that. You can go into clean room and do it. But I'm talking about culture. I'm talking about Terminator. I'm talking about like Superman, heroes, the idea of these things. Like, you can't grow up in a cultural vacuum and do that. If you're looking at something more technical, that happens to be covered by copyright.
But if you were right, every movie that comes out would require permission from half a dozen authors because the culture has got the various themes that show up, and that isn't actually what happens.
I think that oftentimes people could sue if they wanted to, they don't. And I think that just the way that people have carved...
As a law student, you know people can always sue if they want to. The question is whether they'll win. So the argument I'm making is that easy long protection for patents would result in too much property in that area because it's a form of property where the cost of maintaining a property system is high. It would also over-reward inventors because since it is quite common for the same invention to be made by more than one person within a not very long period of time, you would be getting a ownership of the idea much longer than the period that you were actually responsible for. Whereas in the case of an ordinary book, the book is never going to be written by anybody else, and consequently, giving you long control over it is not, in fact, giving you value that you have not yourself created. All right. Those who are interested, there's a chapter in my webbed Law's Order which goes into this particular argument in more detail. You may or may not find it convincing, but since I'm trying to cover all of law and econ in about an hour, I think I'd better keep going. The next point I wanted to make is in the particular case of real property, meaning land, what we think of as the ownership of a piece of land is really the ownership of a bundle of rights with regard to that land. That, for example, ownership of the land does not let me prohibit United Airlines from flying an airplane 5 miles over my head. It does let me prohibit you from crossing my land, except that if you happen to be driving a car along the south side of the south side of Williams Road in front of my house, even though you are, I think, crossing over my property, the house being 100 years old, due to a previous owner having given the city of San Jose an easement, you do have the right in that case to cross my property. So this raises the interesting economic question, what ought to be in the bundle? How do we decide what belongs in the bundle of rights we call ownership of land? And it's tempting to say everything connected to that piece of land, but that can't work because there are some rights that are connected to more than one piece of land. For example, my right to make noise next to my boundary results in there being noise next to your side of the boundary. Who owns it? And the kind of analysis that comes out of the work of Ronald Koser, out of his perspective on the law, suggests that what you really want to ask is what rights ought to be in the same bundle. So that, for example, if I have the right to grow crops on the land, that right is valueless without the right to go on the land, because I can't farm the land without being there. It's not worth very much without the right to exclude trespassers, at least when my crops are growing in the field, because they'll trample the crops. So that kind of approach suggests that you want to make up a bundle with a set of rights that are connected in the sense that they are likely to all, that the owner of one is likely to be the person with the highest value for the others. You can never do it perfectly because of the fact that often there are rights of value in orders. And so the second thing you want to think about is, if we get it wrong, how easy will it be for people to rearrange those rights into the efficient thing by private contract? So if you think about overflights or radio broadcasts through your land, if the legal rule were, I own the right to prohibit radio broadcasts going across my land, then in order to have a radio station, you would need the unanimous assent of everybody within range of your transmitter, which would be horrendously difficult to get. If the rule were, you can transmit without my permission, but you owe me damages for any damage actually done, then since no damage is actually done, unless perhaps I'm right next to the transmitter, there would be no particular problem. And you can think in general of how you would formulate your property rights, with the first principle being put everything in the bundle that belongs together, and the second principle, since you won't do it right, try to define your rights in such a way that transactions to rearrange the bundle when you make mistakes will be as easy as possible. And that is a very abbreviated description of stuff I spent a couple of weeks on in the course. So. Consider, however, my favorite example, which is the state of Pennsylvania, which I don't know if any of you have ever gotten to that distant and exotic part of the world, but Pennsylvania, as you can see when you drive through the by the highway, cuts on the highway, is largely out of coal. There are these black layers in the rock. And the result is that traditional Pennsylvania property law recognized three different estates in land: the surface estate, the mineral estate, and the support estate. What do you think the support of the state is?
Enforcement is whatever keeps it up, keeps up the top level.
Well,
or whatever's next door that if you remove it, would have it slide out.
That's lateral support, but it isn't the stuff, it's the right. That is to say, the support estate is the right to have the surface stay where it is instead of falling into a hole. So, if I own the surface estate and the support estate, and you own the mineral estate, you're allowed to mine the coal out from under my land, but you have to leave enough there so my land won't fall down. If I own the surface estate and you own the mineral estate and the support estate, on the other hand, my house stays where it was put only on your sufferance. All right. Now, that's not an unreasonable arrangement, given that in many places there aren't any houses, and the person who most values that support estate really is the guy mining the coal, who doesn't want to have to worry about whether or not there are occasional cave-ins, whereas in other places, obviously, they do. And again, you can have transactions easily enough so that if you own the support estate and the mineral estate, and I'm thinking of building a house, before I build a house, I go to you and say, I'd like to buy the support estate for this 100-foot by 100-foot square, which I'm going to put my house on, and we negotiate a price. As I say, I think I'm out of date on this, but from my standpoint, I don't really care what current law is, since I'm not going to be a lawyer. I just care what law was at some point when it allowed me to make an interesting point about the nature of law. All right, so that's property law, which is normally a week or two in the class. Let's go on to tort. And one of my standard examples of the sort of thing that makes people think that economists are either crazy or wicked is that economists believe that there is an optimal level of auto accidents. And the optimal level of auto accidents is not zero. It would be nice to have zero, but how would we get zero auto accidents? Anybody like to suggest any simple ways of drastically reducing the number of auto accidents?
Nobody rides cars for the car.
That's the easiest way.
Nobody rides cars.
Oh, yeah.
It's one way to do it.
My friend Gordon Tulloch had a couple... My friend Gordon Tulloch had a couple of sort of more entertaining versions of that. And they involved minor safety modifications to automobiles. And the low-tech version was a dagger that you have attached to every steering wheel pointing this way. And he argued, I think correctly, that there would be very few accidents under those circumstances. The high-tech version, however, still uses off-the-shelf technology. You take the systems we now use to set off airbags to detect when there's been an accident, but instead of attaching this experimental and very elaborate airbag system, you use nice, simple, off-the-shelf hardware, namely a hand grenade. So anytime you have a crash, the hand grenade goes off. And again, I think he correctly argued that would drastically reduce the number of auto accidents. So given that we don't really want to reduce auto accidents, whatever the cost, what we really want to do is to get people to take precautions as long as the cost of an additional precaution is less than the benefit from reduced accidents. And we can use a legal system to try to get people to behave that way. One possible rule is strict liability, which says if I'm responsible for the accident, I have to not only pay my medical bills, I've got to pay your medical bills too. A different rule is negligence, which says not if I'm responsible for the accident, but if there are precautions I could have taken to prevent the accident that were worth taking and I didn't take them. So I should say this is negligence as economists interpret it. There is a famous bit of law, so-called Hand formula from Learned Hand, which is a judge who is interpreting negligence in the economist's way, but it certainly is not described the way all judges interpret negligence. But the economist version, at least, is that you are negligent if you have not taken all cost-justified precautions. And the as Coase reminded us, those of us who remember what he said about Coase earlier, generally both parties are have some effect on what happens. So that ideally we'd like to not only give an incentive to me not to drive dangerously, but also to you not to do things that make it more likely that my dangerous driving will result in bad things happening. Can you give simple examples of decisions that you make that nobody would think of as being wicked or at fault, which nonetheless raise the cost of accidents?
Increase the cost?
Speeding?
That's perfectly legit. That there are laws. I was thinking much simpler. A good many years ago, one of my colleagues at the law school and his wife were over to visit, and their Mercedes was parked in my driveway, and pulling my car out, I didn't notice it was there or something, and put a not very large dent in their car, and discovered to my horror how expensive it was to get a Mercedes fixed, because I was obviously obligated to fix the dent I put in their car. Well, the decision to drive a Mercedes instead of a Ford, or a new Ford instead of a beat-up Ford, imposes accident costs, because it means that if an accident happens, the cost of repairing will be higher. None of us would think of it as morally wicked to drive a Mercedes or to drive a new car instead of an old car, and yet it is a decision which, as it were, is made by the victim, which affects the costs of accidents occurring. And an ideal system would be one in which, when you decided what car to own, one of the many considerations would be, if somebody else damages it, how much will it cost him to fix it for me? Along with lots of other considerations, obviously. Let's start by ignoring that. Let's start with the easy case of the one-sided injury, where, for a moment, I'll assume the victim doesn't affect it, and that only the victim is hurt. And in that case, strict liability looks as though it gives us the right result, because the driver, after all, is bearing all of the cost of the accident. So his incentive to take precautions is exactly what it ought to be, namely, if the accident does $10,000 worth of damage, if he can reduce the chance by 1% for a cost of less than $100 to him, it pays him to do it, and that's just what we want him to do. Does that part make sense? Notice, however, that negligence, so far, has exactly the same effect, because under a negligence rule, if he fails to take all of those precautions that are worth taking, he will be liable. And if he's liable, it's in his interest to take all precautions that are worth taking. Does that make sense? It's a little bit tricky, but if you think about it, the negligence rule says you may either take all precautions worth taking or not. If you don't, you're going to be liable. But if you are going to be liable, then all the costs go to you. So any precaution worth taking is one worth taking for you, because you're the only person who's bearing the costs. So that means that the negligence rule and the strict liability rule appear to give exactly the same level of precautions. The only difference so far is that strict liability will have more lawsuits, because even if you're not negligent, you're liable, but there'll be easier suits because you won't have to prove negligence. However, this assumes that the court knows whether you've been negligent. It's useful for simplicity to divide all precautions into two categories. Precautions which are observable, by which I mean precautions where the court can tell both what precautions you took and whether you should have. And precautions which are unobservable, in the sense that either the court doesn't know if you took them or it has no way of judging whether you should have taken them. And people often, in the law and econ literature, including in our book, refer to unobservable precaution as activity level, because the particular unobservable precaution they're thinking about is not driving today. That if I say, imagine I drive in a perfectly cautious fashion, but I didn't really have to take the trip at all, and even when I drive cautiously, there's some chance of an accident happening, so therefore, in effect, I have failed to take the precaution that would prevent that particular accident, namely staying home. Since the court can't know how important it is for me to drive today, it can't, in practice, hold me negligent because I drove, which means that a strict liability rule, I will take account both in deciding what precautions to take and in deciding whether to drive of the costs I impose, because if I am not negligent and run you down because I took this trip, the result will be that I'll have to pay for your hospital expenses, and that's one reason to consider in deciding whether to take the trip. Under a negligence rule, if I'm planning not to be negligent in the court sense, to take all observable precautions that I ought to take, then I won't be liable. Since I won't be liable, I don't have to worry about the cost to you of getting hurt if I drive. Right. So what that tells us is that under negligence, the rational driver takes the optimal level of observable precautions, but has no incentive to take unobservable precautions. Whereas under strict liability, it's in his interest to take the optimal level of both observable and unobservable precautions. So that is one advantage for strict liability. Let me go back.
Why don't we take those into consideration about some of the unobservable ones?
Unobservable, you can't distinguish. Like,
why doesn't the driver or the court?
Like when they're making to me, it seems that they would take into consideration if you really needed to drive at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, or if he's attentive because he hadn't slept for 24 hours. Like, they would take that into consideration.
If he hadn't slept for 24 hours, they might well take that into consideration. But the general question of how many times how many miles a year does he drive? I don't think you're ever going to say, because you drive, 10,000 miles a year instead of 9,000, therefore you're negligent.
But they do that with the ticket system already.
What do you mean?
So, like, if you get tickets, speeding tickets, like, there's a point system there in California, you get too many, you lose your license. So if you drive a lot for work or some purpose that they deem acceptable, you can get more points in your license. Like, you have a bigger, you have more leeway. So I don't see why they wouldn't take those things.
I think if you look at how tort law works in general, that when you define someone as negligent, it's normally for how he did what he did, not for whether he did it at all. Right? If you think of activity level as how often you do whatever the activity is, then the activity level is going to be something which is at least not normally taken as a measure of negligence. So I've never heard of its being such. No?
I guess so. I mean, I see, it just doesn't fit well with me. Just because I see if you drive a lot, someone's going to bring that up and say, okay, well, this time you did something different, or whatever. That's going to be, a reason why you were negligent in this case.
But also, notice that the argument I really want to make is about unobservable precautions, and activity level is usually used as shorthand because it's a standard example. But could just as easily be that the reason I didn't step on my brake fast enough when the guy ahead of me stomped was that I was in the middle of having an argument with one of my friends inside my head, and therefore wasn't paying attention. And they might be able to say, if you were paying attention, you would have stepped on your brake. But where they can't see that, because they may not know enough about their evidence, they can't say, because you were thinking about something else, you were negligent, because they have no way of knowing that I was thinking about something else. And I know that I was thinking about something else. And so under a strict liability system, I have an incentive to take account of that in my decisions. Let me go back a step, though, because there's an interesting implication of this, which is due to Posner, and I might be right, and that is there are certain torts that are thought as strict liability torts. And the standard example is ultra-hazardous activities, where one example of that would be using dynamite to remove tree stumps, and another might be keeping a pet tiger in an area where other people lived. And my understanding is that even if you could show that the tiger got out through no fault of your own, it was an earthquake or something you couldn't have anticipated, you're still liable. And similarly in the case, even if you did your blasting with all reasonable precaution, my understanding is you're still not liable under a strict liability rule. And I think Posner's argument is that those are particular cases where it is quite likely that the most important precaution to be taken is not to do it at all, precisely because they're things that can't be done without substantial risk, and that therefore you want your strict liability to give you an incentive on that margin. Let's go on to the more reasonable, more plausible case where both parties can take precautions. Now, under strict liability, the driver has an incentive to take the efficient level of precautions, but if we are really fully compensating people, the pedestrian has no incentive to take precautions at all. Now, it's true, it's hard to fully compensate you for being killed, but you can think of lots of other torts where that's not the case. If we said people aren't liable at all, we would exactly reverse the situation. If the driver is not liable, what is the driver's incentive to take precautions?
For pedestrians,
nothing. What is the pedestrian's incentive to take precautions?
100%.
And similarly,
well, already pretty well incentivized. But.
Going back to my case of deading my colleagues.
It reminds me of there's this part this weekend. Never mind. Sorry. Her story.
I was going to say that in the case of Denning, George Alexander's, or maybe his wife's lecture at Mercedes many years ago, in a world where I wasn't liable and didn't consider myself liable, that would increase the incentive not to own a Mercedes. Because you would then say, well, if somebody does dent it, happen, you know, I'll have to repair it myself. A negligence rule, if all precautions are observable, if we forget the problem of unobservable precautions, now a negligence rule is quite an elegant solution, because with negligence rule, what precautions does the driver take? We went through that before.
Reasonable
precautions. He'll take any cost-justified precaution, any precaution which saves more in accident costs than it costs. What precautions will the pedestrian take under a negligence rule applied to the driver? Will he?
Less than strict.
No. Under strict liability, the pedestrian takes no precautions at all, but he's going to be compensated by the driver.
Well, I don't think they take no precautions at all. Because
this is assuming full compensation, I understand. But
well, full compensation for death.
Full compensation.
So you revived?
No. There are lots of possible injuries other than death.
No, I know, but I'm just saying, like, most people will get hit by a car. He has not zero.
We aren't talking about auto accidents. We're talking about tort law.
Yeah, no, I know, but I'm just saying.
Auto accidents provide a useful example, but taking special characteristics of the auto accidents in order to, it seems to me, just muddies the attempt to think through the logic of tort law. And so at the moment, we will get to not fully compensated in time. At the moment, we are assuming what tort law claims to do, which is to make whole the injury.
But even if all injuries can be made whole, people still have like a nominal level of distaste for accidents or hassle or whatever, right?
If that were true, that would just mean that they hadn't been made whole. Instead, they pay a little more. if we have a negligence rule, will drivers be negligent?
Yeah, of course.
Why? Why would you be negligent if you knew that being negligent meant that you'd be liable?
Some people don't care.
We're assuming people are rational. We're trying to think through the implications of the economic assumption of rational behavior for the law.
Yeah.
The observation that is not a perfect model of human behavior, while certainly true, is not very useful for that project. All right. Again, in the model of behavior we are using, will drivers choose to be negligent? If the driver is negligent, he's liable. Negligence means failure to take all costs justified precautions. And if you're going to be liable, then all the costs go to you.
Individual costs as opposed to, it's getting rid of the moral hazard of not necessarily partitioning costs, lining them up with benefits.
I'm assuming at this step in the analysis, I am assuming that liability, strict or negligence, really means what it claims to mean, namely, I've got to fully compensate the victim for whatever has happened. So now, if I have to fully compensate the victim, is it ever in my interest to be negligent? Very good, it is not. Since the driver is not negligent, what is going to happen when the driver runs into the, when the not driving, non-negligently runs into the pedestrian? Who's going to pay for that accident? Since the pedestrian knows he will pay for the accident, what precautions will the pedestrian take? Very good. So that it's sort of a toy solution because it depends on assuming that the court can recognize negligence. But it's nonetheless quite an elegant toy solution because it does tell you that under those assumptions, both parties to a jointly caused accident have the efficient incentives. All right.
But people could still have rational reasons for driving negligently with respect to pedestrians. Say, for instance, a truck was barreling down on them or something like that. They're still breaching the duty to the pedestrians to drive with all due care or something.
We define negligence as failing to take all cost-justified precautions. Getting run down by a truck is not a cost-justified precaution.
Yeah, but if they were to take, say they're saying, instead of running into the lane to the left with other cars, where they might have an auto accident, where they may be more harmed or something like that, or they move off into the...
All I'm saying is that, again, I agree that the law does not, that the legal definitions of negligence don't perfectly map to the economist's definitions.
Okay.
But so one way of thinking about this is that there are, in a way, two different approaches to getting people to do to act in the efficient or optimal or whatever fashion. One of them is for some external authority to figure out what they ought to do and make them do it. And the other is to make them bear all the relevant costs so it'll be in their interest to figure it out themselves and do it. And this particular solution is applying one of those to one to the driver and the other one to the pedestrian. Then the driver is being non-negligent as defined by the court. So the court is really deciding what he has to do and saying, look what happens to you if you don't do it. And given that, we then have the other method left over to use for the pedestrian, which gets him to do the right. So as I say, once not all precautions are observable, once courts make errors, this breaks down. It's still a needed solution. Now let's think about some other solutions, which I'm going to include, among others, a more realistic picture of how damages really work. But let me start with a different one. And that is, suppose we make both pedestrian and driver each bear the full cost. In other words, we have the total cost paid twice. How do you do that? You fine the driver the amount of the damage, but you don't give the money to the pedestrian. So now the driver stands to lose all of it and the pedestrian, so each of them has the full incentive. And that, of course, is exactly the way the criminal system works, because criminal fines don't go to the victim. On the other hand, one of the disadvantages of the criminal system is that now the accident never gets reported, because you're the driver, you've just run down the pedestrian, fortunately he's still alive and sufficiently conscious to bargain with you. What's the first thing you say to the pedestrian after running him down?
Are you okay?
Yeah, what's the second thing you say to him? I'll pay half your injuries if you agree not to report this accident, right? Because that saves me money, it saves you, and no need to get the law involved. So, Now let's take another one, which gets us to what I suspect to some extent really happens, and that's the co-insurance solution, which says the driver will partly compensate the pedestrian. The result is the driver doesn't have as much incentive as he should to be careful, but he at least has a good deal of incentive to be careful. So the driver won't take the precaution that saves $100 at a cost of $90, but he will take the precaution that saves $100 at the cost of $40 because he's paying something like half the total cost. Similarly, the pedestrian is now left with half the cost. Therefore, the pedestrian doesn't have the full incentive, but he has an incentive to take at least those precautions that really give you a lot of bang for your buck, so to speak. Right? And that's what we think of in the insurance literature as co-insurance, where we say, if I'm insured for only part of the value of my factory, I will at least make a reasonable effort to keep it from burning down, even if not as much effort as I really should. And my suspicion, though I may be wrong, is that in the real tort system, now if we consider the case of auto accidents, that's exactly what happens, that you do occasionally see bumper stickers which say, hit me, I need the money, but I think they're lying. It's a joke, and my impression is that for almost everybody, what you actually expect to get in damages is not enough, so you would say, great, do it again. Let's go on to another issue, and that's the meaning of causation. Because causation is one of these terms which sounds pretty clear until you start thinking about it, and then it starts getting gradually fuzzier and fuzzier. And one common approach is what's referred to as but-for causation. When you say, but for what you did, it wouldn't have happened. And then I have here my standard counterexample to but-for causation. So tell me, did you cause his death? But for you, he'd be alive and well. And if you caused his death, should you be liable for it?
No, because the person chose to stop and talk to you, you couldn't have walked.
It's
that person's, choice to stop.
That's a legitimate answer, although not the one I'm trying to get at. So let us suppose that...
grab them by the arm and stop them from walking away.
Yeah, I suppose I said to him, look, I've got this wonderful news. I've got to tell you, she's finally agreed to marry me. And you wouldn't let go of his arm for, a minute and a half of burbling about how great it was that the girl you've been chasing finally agreed to marry you. And finally he said, look, I've got to go. And he tears free and walks down and the barrel falls on his head. Now are you liable?
I mean, I guess you're partly responsible. Sort of. Whether he pays you how liable for it's like...
Should you be?
No.
Why not?
Well, it's the failure of using the standard of care with respect to the barrel, not with respect to his, walking.
Well, that is, certainly you could argue that whoever's responsible for the barrel should be liable too, but why shouldn't you be liable?
It's not foreseeable that the barrel doesn't happen.
Foreseeability is the language the law uses. Can anybody put it in our language, if we ask what incentives we want to give people, would making you liable, in fact, give you because what? It's going back to your answer, but it's a different way of getting there. It wouldn't, because you didn't, in fact, know when the barrel was going to fall. Right?
So it would actually just incentivize people to not go outside because you'd be liable for people.
Or to not enthusiastically grab their friends in arms when they... girl they've been courting for 3 years finally agreed to marry me. More than 3 years in my case, but I'm not that excitable. But in any case, it was actually quite funny since I had proposed to Betty first probably 4 years or so before that. I was teaching at UCLA and she was in New Orleans and we were staying in close contact. And one day we were talking on the phone and she said, I have an idea. Why don't we get married? And I've always regretted that I didn't was it fast enough to say, that's a great idea, why didn't I think of it? Anyway, that was a long time ago and it worked just fine. So, I can recommend long-term contracts. But in any case, so one way of putting it is that you're stopping him had a one chance in a million of killing him, had a one chance in a million of saving him. Because after all, the barrel could have dropped a minute earlier. So in terms of what you knew, it did not increase the risk of his dying, and so we don't want to give you an incentive not to do it. There is, in fact, a real legal case which corresponds to this. It's a different one. This is a case where you had, I think, a bus or something like a bus, and a tree falls on it and injures somebody. And the injured person or his attorney was able to prove that the bus could not have been where it was when the tree fell if it hadn't broken the speed limit at some point on the way. And the argument was that breaking the law was per se negligence. Hence, the negligence resulted in the accident. And they did not win the case. And I think the basic answer was probably put in foreseeability, but I would have put it in terms of causation, that that's not the right kind of causation, given that the negligence did not change the probability of your being under the tree when it fell. Take my next bizarre case, which actually also corresponds to a real, although less dramatic case, and that's the one where three men go hunting, and two of them think the third is a deer, and one of them shoots him through the head and one through the heart simultaneously. And when they are sued by his widow, each of them says, but wait a minute, I did him no harm at all. Bullet through the heart does no harm to a guy who's just gotten a bullet through the head. Bullet through the head does no harm to a guy who's just gotten a bullet through the heart. I mean, it's true, it's going to cost the mortician a little bit more to make him look nice for the funeral, and we'll happily pay that. But neither of us killed him. Any opinions?
Well, they could both be liable. Because either one of their actions could have killed him, so...
But neither action did. They wouldn't be liable if they missed.
No, I know, but... You're trying to incentivize them to be more careful with their firearms.
How careful?
How careful? What do you mean?
I mean, if you want to incentivize them to be more careful, you could just say, well, you're not allowed to go hunting. That would make them real careful.
Yeah.
Or you could say, any time that you shoot within 100 yards of somebody, we'll find you. That is, thinking about it as wanting to be more careful is really not the right way to think about it, except at the end of a chain of argument, not the beginning. What you really want is for them to be the right level of careful. And the right level of careful is taking all cost-justified precautions. And if you work it through, if we could really make sure that when only one bullet hit him, you pay the full damages, which, as you pointed out before, we can't, but if we could, then making you also liable to the two-bullet case really would give you too much deterrence, because it really is the case that the extra small probability of killing him, which doesn't kill him because he's dead at the same time anyway, doesn't do any damage. But again, if you're curious, I discuss it in more detail in the textbook, which is on the web, and you can look at it. It's sort of a paradoxical case. Anybody want to guess what the real case is that I'm blowing up into this one? What? No. As far as I know, only one bullet hit that person. It's a case involving fires. It's a case where a building is destroyed, in effect, by two different fires. And the question is, given that it would have been destroyed in a few minutes by that fire, am I liable for negligently causing this fire, which destroyed it? I think just before, I'm not sure. And I think he was found negligent. I think they were found negligent in that case. But I like my version better. It's a more memorable story. But in each of these cases, the question the economists want to ask is, what legal rule gives the right incentive? All right. With not more incentive. You see, my point is the only reason we want them to be safer is that we believe that the straightforward legal rule of liability when you do kill him doesn't, because we can't make the liability large enough, they can't pay enough, therefore that gives us a below optimal incentive. But we don't want an above optimal incentive either. So it's not that you want people to be safer. I don't know if any of you people are students of ancient history, but there was a time when Coke bottles were made out of glass. And there were real legal cases involving the fact that a Coke bottle has gas under pressure, and therefore under some circumstances it can briefly turn into a hand grenade.
It's still made out of glass.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, in Somalia maybe? Okay. Grocery stores have glass Pokemons? They haven't noticed in the Midwest?
Some places have.
Not a lot, it's not common.
Yeah, they're all the ones I see in plastic. So, the question is, given that one reason it could explode was they didn't do a good enough job when they washed the bottle to make sure it didn't have any cracks in it, should they be liable? This may not last much longer. I'm running out. Suppose the rule is the old common rule of Kofi Annan, which says you take the bottle as you find it, including the risk. Will Coke take the optimal level of precautions to prevent such accidents from happening?
No.
Because?
Because they don't have the liability on them.
Under what circumstance, without liability, would they still take the optimal precautions?
I mean, if it's
going to
affect their business, I guess.
If, putting more simply, if the customers actually had an accurate picture of how often such explosions happened. Because then, the more often they happen, the greater the risk you're getting with your Coke bottle, the less valuable the Coke bottle is to you. So for fully informed customers, Kofi Annan would still give them the essential precautions, just as, after all, we don't need a liability rule to make auto manufacturers put tires on the cars they sell. That's a characteristic. People want it. Well, safety is another characteristic. On the other hand, if the consumer doesn't know, then, as you say, Coke has no reason to care in a non-liability rule world, and that's the argument as Kofi Annan. How about Kofi Annan? Suppose that Coke is liable. What's the downside of that going to be in terms of our previous analysis?
To have your bottle?
Why, to have it? Won't Coke say, the heavier the bottle, the more it costs us to make? We're going to trade that off against safety. Those are both costs we're bearing because we're now liable for any injuries. So wouldn't we get exactly the right weight of bottle?
Can you explain that again?
Sure. Coke says we can make the bottle thicker, which makes the explosion less likely. That has costs. There's more glass. It's going to be more expensive transporting heavier bottles. Maybe our customers won't like heavier bottles as much, but it has a benefit. It reduces the chance of the accident. Coke is bearing the costs. Coke is receiving the benefit because they're going to be liable for the accident now. So isn't it their incentive to trade off costs to get the benefits and get the optimal combination? He said too heavy. I'm saying be heavier, but it won't be too heavy. It'll be just heavy enough.
I don't know about that. Because I think that it could be optimal from their perspective, maybe not from society's perspective.
But the whole point of the liability rule is to make those the same. That's right, what we're really talking about. What we've really been talking about is how we set up legal rules in which what's optimal from the actor's perspective is the same as what's optimal from society's perspective. So why is it not optimal? Why would they make it heavier than optimal from society's standpoint? Bottles, given that they were doing optimal ones from their standpoint.
No, I mean, for society, having any accidents isn't acceptable.
It isn't?
I don't think so. With Coke bottle, I don't know.
So you're in favor of abolishing the soda bottles?
Well, something safer then. Something safer. Because the consumer can't, realize the consumer can't take into consideration. They don't know if the bottle's safe or not safe when they're thinking about picking it up on the shelf, right?
If you think that you should abolish all accidents, presumably that means you want to ban all cars, only one-story buildings.
No, there's certain risks society deems are acceptable, and there's other ones.
I just don't understand that way of thinking. It seems to me that in each case, there are costs, there are benefits, and you try to figure out whether you can reduce this risk at a cost that is less than the same as reducing the risk, and there's no particular reason to assume that the optimal level is zero. If the cost of getting down the number of exploding Coke bottles from one a year to zero were $100 million a year, would it be worth doing?
From Coke's perspective?
No, from society's standpoint.
Well, they're not paying that money.
Sure they are.
You think
Coke somehow has a magic fountain that money comes out?
No, but they're making a determination. It wouldn't necessarily be the $100 million, is what I'm saying. Because you're saying to make the bottle safer, that doesn't necessarily take into consideration switching the container, right?
All I'm saying is your claim is that they ought to do things that reduce the accident rate to zero. And I'm saying that's absurd as a general proposition. And that whether they should use it to zero depends what it costs. If it happens, it's the cheapest way. I don't think I understand yours. Maybe you can explain it in greater length when I'm more capable of arguing without losing my voice doing it. I want to go back to caveat venditor, though. And I want to say the argument so far suggests that caveat venditor gives Coke the right incentives. Who else? Are there other incentives you ought to be worrying about?
I was just thinking along the lines of, we read some cases in Tort's class about car manufacturers, and you have the negligence rule, and so you would think they would keep that in mind when they're making their products. But there, in a lot of these cases, apparently the car company knew that they were putting in certain parts that would cause an explosion, let's say, for example. Where like a gas tank was exploding, and they knew that this tank had more of a likelihood to explode. And but because the part was so much cheaper, I guess, than the upgrade, they factored in and thought, you know what, our lawsuits are going to be less expensive than this part.
What's the problem with that?
Well,
isn't that the right thing to do? Do you want to pay any cost for safety, however high?
Well, that's the problem. Is the customer doesn't know that they're making the determination.
Right.
The customer can't be fully informed about the decision they're making.
Which is precisely the argument for liability law. If the customer is fully informed, then even if the car company wasn't liable.
But this is real life. And in real life, if someone dies or loses a limb, you can't really be fully compensated. So yeah. That's the problem. This analysis doesn't really take that into consideration because money can only get you so far, right?
I agree that the question of value of life is an interesting one. Fortunately, I have a chapter on that subject in Law's Order, which you can read if you like, but I don't have the time to go into it.
Sure.
At the point I'm making at the moment, do you think life is infinitely valuable?
I mean, my life, sure. I'm not
going to
take
I don't believe you.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to take any amount of money.
that's a different question. For a moment, if you think your life is infinitely valuable, then you are willing to spend any sum of money, however large, for any reduction in the chance of death, however small, that nobody I know acts that way.
Okay.
Right, you could buy a more expensive car that was safer. If your life were infinitely valuable to you, you would.
Sure.
So I suggest the reason that people were not willing to sell their lives for any sum of money is not that life is infinitely valuable, it's that money is worthless to a corpse. That you're confusing dividing by zero and multiplying by infinity.
Okay.
Now you think about it, because I think that's the right answer.
Yeah, I understand.
But anyway, going back though, the question is suppose, in terms of the general proposition, if you as an individual presumably know that some cars are safer than others, and you also know that on the whole, safer cars will be more expensive. You as an individual would not be willing to pay an unlimited amount more for a safer car. So why should the car companies be required to make more expensive cars as long as they're safer? However, whatever the trade-off is between expense and safety, is it the right thing for them to do? To say, how much safety are we getting for how much additional cost? And at some point to say, all right, saving one life at the cost of an extra $100 million, that's too high. Cost of an extra $5 million, that's about right. Whatever the ratio is that reflects the value to their customers of their lives, as shown by what their customers would pay for safety. Isn't that the right rule?
It can't be, because why then do we have regulations like cars have to have seatbelts? That's a big
I'm a little curious. Are you starting out from the assumption that all laws are correct? What do you think of the war on drugs? It must be that marijuana is a deadly thing, because otherwise you wouldn't have very high penalties for smoking, right? Right. So that line of argument doesn't kill.
There could be certain situations where the auto industry may not be concerned about providing seatbelts.
There might well be arguments for seatbelt laws. That's not my point. My only point is the existence of seatbelt laws don't show that there are good arguments.
No, of course.
A separate proposition. But for a moment, the point I'm making is that to the extent that the actor is bearing all the costs of his acts, he will be trading off different things, and that while it's rhetorically satisfying to say you should never trade money against life, it's also insane, because all of us routinely trade money, leisure, the taste of ice cream. Every time I eat a Baskin Robbins ice cream cone, I'm trading a what?
Yeah, clock
ticket. I'm trading not money in that case, but a different, you know.
But that's different though, because that's you as an individual making a determination about your life and your value. In the other example, we're talking about a company making a determination that you don't know they're making.
It seems to me what you're actually talking about here is the government making a determination for you about what determination the company should make. I'm not sure that's any better.
Exactly, that's my point. Like, but, either way, that doesn't make it. That means optimal.
And as I was saying, the point of liability rule, of a liability law, is to attempt imperfectly to give the company the right incentive by saying that if it does have this consequence, they're going to have to pay for it. A different way would be to have well-publicized statistics on which cars, you know, blow up, how often, since that would then give the customer the chance to make the choice you want him to make. But I still want to go back to the question of the disadvantage of caveat vendor. All you're saying, caveat vendor isn't enough. And what I want to argue is that in some sense it's too much, because we've forgotten the possibility that the user might be responsible for the accident or as well as the producer. And that's why the story I want to tell you is the one where that particular, the Coke that blew up in my face when I was not wearing glasses, it was on the 4th of July, and it had it sitting by the podium where I was going to give my speech for 36 hours at a temperature outside of 102. And I then picked up the bottle because I wanted a bottle of Coke. It hadn't yet occurred to me it wasn't going to taste very good at that temperature. And I was making a particularly dramatic point in my speech when the bottle blew up. It's clearly Coke's fault, right?
Well, I think that if your abstraction is so strong as to include that all parties are rational,
yep,
then you must also include that all uses are rational.
Of course,
so,
of course.
And then caveat vendor is perfect.
Wait a minute. No. On the contrary. If I'm rational and the rule is caveat vendor, then I have no reason to avoid doing what I've just described. Because when it blows up with a fully compensating system, Coke is going to compensate me. I am precisely assuming everybody is fully rational. And what I'm saying is that the disadvantage of caveat, just as one problem with strict liability, is that the pedestrian has no incentive to take precautions. One problem with caveat vendor is that the user then has no incentive to take precautions.
But unless there is some sort of like magical, instantaneous, like, cure to your problem, people are still going to be the cost, even to the rational human being, of the injury, recovery, going to court. Even if you get all your money back, or let's say you get like a new robotic hand, who cares? Whatever it is, you're full. There's still that time loss, and a perfectly rational person will have to weigh that time loss, which may be substantial.
That only means that, again, you're assuming that the compensation is not fully compensation. You're compensating, and I agree.
How do you get the time back?
You pay for time.
Time is worth money to people. They make that trade-off all the time.
Yeah, no, I know.
I'm trying to think through the logic of a problem,
right.
And you don't get very far if you try to introduce all possible complications at the stage when you're working through the logical structure of the problem.
Right.
I have no objection to saying we've gotten this far. Now, what happens if we worry about value of life? I just had a chapter, I published an article on that question.
But then
I don't care.
It's really hard to get rid of the definition of rational behavior. You know, how you define it is.
That the rational behavior is taking account of all your costs and benefits, seeing to what extent it best achieves the objectives you like.
Right. But then if they're
so
having your hand, you know, having a Coke bottle still in your hand, you know, completely ignoring the time pain.
But notice that what you're doing is not choosing to have it explode in your hand. You're choosing to do things that have a very small risk of having it explode in your hand. And I don't think, you know, you drive a car, I presume. You know that driving a car could cost you your arm, or your leg, or your life. It's not very likely to. And you presumably take some trips, but you don't have to take those trips. But all of us do. It just seems to me that putting it in terms of imagining that what you're doing is picking up something you know will cost you your hand, and then saying that's irrational, is missing the fact that what we're really doing, all of our lives, as it were, is making choices about activities which have various risks. We rarely, only in desperate circumstances, we do things that we expect to kill us, but we quite routinely do things that we know are a little bit more likely to kill us than something else we can do.
Well, But under caveat that deter, even if so, if the rational user is someone who uses it recklessly for no care, correct? They know they're going to be fully compensated.
That's right. That's the rational user is somebody who.
They're using a buzzsaw to cut a pencil and they're holding it with their hand. Like, well, that, it doesn't matter. That, whatever it is.
That's not rational. You've got pencils much more easy without a buzzsaw.
No, I know. But I'm just saying. Like,
but they don't worry about those costs that will be compensated.
At all about it. Then
about those costs that will be compensated.
But right? The manufacturer knows this as well.
That's right.
So it wouldn't be. You know what I'm saying? I'm sorry to say, but if the manufacturer is rational as well, he understands that they're going to be reckless.
Of course.
He's
of course.
The only one liable.
Of course.
And it will be perfect for that situation.
Then what?
Then the size of the thickness of the Coke bottle.
Well, the manufacturer will make the thickness of the Coke bottle right, but the user is not taking the efficient level of precaution.
Yeah, no, you're going to understand that, but the bottle will be made correctly.
According
to the situation.
But it will then be used incorrectly. It would have been a lower total cost for the two combined if I had been much more careful with the bottle. And therefore, we would like, if possible, to get legal rules which get everybody to take the optimal precautions. And I'm discussing the difficulty in doing so because exactly the legal rule that gets the manufacturer to take the optimal precautions makes it not in the interest of the user to, and vice versa. That's the point I'm making. Let's consider a third alternative, and that's one in which you have default rules but you're allowed to contract around them. And so now, if I, as the consumer, say that I would be much more comfortable buying Coke bottles if I knew that Coke would compensate me if I was injured, I could then go to Coke and Pepsi and other people and say, are any people offering a guarantee? And assuming that a reasonable number of customers felt that way, somebody would find it in his interest to offer a guarantee and charge 2 cents more for his bottle or whatever, at which point we would be contractually changing caveat emptor into caveat venditor for those consumers. Alternatively, if we start out with a caveat venditor rule, the seller could say to us, look, this caveat venditor business results in a lot of unnecessary lawsuits. I'll give you a discount on the Coke bottles if you'll sign a waiver agreeing I'm not liable. And in either case, you could decide whether to do that. For what it's worth, Cass Sunstein, who's got some connections to the present administration, used to be a law professor at Chicago, has a book in which one of the many things he proposes is that patients should be allowed to agree to waive malpractice liability in exchange for a lower rate from physicians, because he offers some evidence that malpractice suits do very little to prevent malpractice and are quite expensive, basically. All right, we're out of time at this point, but I think this is all up on the web already, and if it's not, it will be, and I'll probably do a little bit more of it next week, although I think we're supposed to be starting on statistics, since we lost a day, I'll probably do a little bit more of this stuff, but for most of the way. But as I say, I think the chapter in the book also does a pretty good job, so I advise you to read that and get a somewhat different perspective, but not very different, because Steve Chappelle is also an economist, not an econ person.